Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the control. How did this thing we call public radio get started? Amid a commercial media world dominated by a handful of corporate giants and basically devoid of news and actual dialogue, how is it that NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered have become two of the top three radio programs in the nation? Has public radio at the national and local level lived up to its founding ideals? And what were those ideals to begin with? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll get an intimate perspective of the culture and history of this thing we in America call public radio from someone who played a key role from its beginning. Jack Mitchell began his career in educational radio in 1964 at WUOM at the University of Michigan and later served as public affairs director at the University of Wisconsin radio station WHA. After a year studying how things work at the BBC, Jack Mitchell became the first producer of the first program from the brand new National Public Radio, a show called All Things Considered. He later served in a number of key roles in public radio, including head of the Wisconsin State Radio Network, three periods as chair of the NPR Board of Directors, and he is now a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Wisconsin. Jack Mitchell is also the author of the book, Listener Supported, The Culture and History of Public Radio, recently published by Prager. The book tells the story of public radio's unlikely birth, following the traditions of public service media and educational broadcasting, running smack into Washington politics, and surviving today, some 34 years later, more or less true to its initial purpose. And we'll talk about the stories in that book and about public radio during this hour. As we do, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Professor Mitchell, good morning. I wanted to just start by having you talk about the origins of public radio in educational radio. The public radio we know today really has its roots in this earlier sort of era in radio.
That's right. It's the radio really in this country was developed by universities. So we don't think of that now, but it was engineers and physicists and that in various universities, particularly in the Midwest, who invented this thing and experimented with it. Obviously, the idea came from Marconi, but in terms of just building equipment and trying to see how it works, that all happened in universities, and so the very first broadcasters in this country actually were universities. And then some of the universities decided to actually try to use the equipment to provide programming that was sort of like the BBC in Britain, which was to be public service and broadly educational, an extension of the university. And so the first major stations in the country were really in the land-grant colleges of the Midwest, places like Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota. That's really where radio began. And later, the commercial people figured out they could make money off this thing, and commercial radio came to dominate. But in the very beginning, it was the non-commercial side that really pioneered, and it was for the idea of public service, of providing information and cultural things that were would help society, help people grow.
Right, yes. You write about the public service ideals of the progressives and an earlier era where newspapers were considered the big newspapers were dominating the news. Essentially, there were many people who felt that they were not serving the public.
That's right. This whole notion of public service and the need to get commercialism out of the media really is not new. That really began back in the progressive era, which was the turn of the 20th century, at which time many people were concerned about the power of big business and government, as far as that goes, which was seen as sort of controlled by business. And there were all kinds of reforms, like antitrust laws and things of this sort, that were put into place at that time. And among the ideas, although it was never really implemented, was that the media were too dominated by corporate interests and the profit motive, and that there needed to be newspapers that would not be for profit, that would be run by universities or foundations or other not-for-profit organizations, in order to be unbiased and to have a range of views presented and to be more objective, more scientific than the yellow journalism of the time. And so that idea, although it never really happened in newspapers, was sort of picked up and carried on in the university radio stations of that, which came on just about that time, and then basically evolved into public radio as we know it now.
Yes. So these educational broadcasters, you know, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and into the 60s, essentially, you know, pursuing these ideas, these sort of, you know, Enlightenment ideas of public service, education in the broadest sense, as some would put it. But it wasn't exactly very highly produced kind
of
program.
No, the stations were, first of all, most of the stations did not survive.
Right.
The commercial people bought out the stations, or the FCC just took licenses away from universities and gave them to commercial broadcasters. So only about 16 or 17 of the stations, of the AM stations, actually survived the 1930s. And as a result, they were not of huge importance on the national scene, and they were run by universities, some of which put reasonable resources into them, but most of them didn't have much to put into it. It was not a high priority. So as a result, they tended to operate on low budgets, and they were not that professional. Some were. Some of the old AM stations were. But then a new generation of FM stations came on in the 1950s, and they were very much shoestring operations because nobody had FM. There were no receivers, so these signals were kind of going off into nowhere.
Right.
And as a result, very little was put into them. They were pretty, very much totally local, totally supported by their local institutions, some of which did it well and some didn't do it so well.
There was this entity that existed during the 50s and 60s called the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. And I know that your outfit in Wisconsin and also Michigan were very much involved in that, as was Illinois.
Illinois was a big leader.
Right. Which, you know, I think many people around here suspect that it was kind of a model or a forerunner to public broadcasting. Can you shed any light on what was the connection between the NAEB, as it was called, and what happened with public broadcasting?
Yeah, well, the NAEB started off as the university broadcasters, the university radio stations, which were centered in our region, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin. And then when television came along, the NAEB switched its focus toward television, which is understandable. There were reserved frequencies for television. Television was the wave of the future. Radio was the old dead medium. So the NAEB, which started in radio, really became a television organization and dominated not so much by the universities as by the East Coast stations like WGBH Television and the major city organizations, Philadelphia, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, where the people are. And so this was really the essence of it, where the strength of radio was in the Midwest universities. And the NAEB pushed very hard to get federal money for public television, which was then educational television. But they worked very diligently to get that, and proposed in 1967 something called the Public Television Act, which would have given federal money to public television. Radio was not included. It was seen as just a total waste of time, total waste of money, because the money went into radio would not be going into television, and the television was where the future was and where the potential influence was. So the NAEB pushed this legislation with Congress. The interesting little story is that a few people, and it's just a handful, managed to get that bill amended so that it included the words "and radio." Every time the word television appeared, "and radio" was stuck in. Came at the last minute. Nobody wanted it. Certainly the TV people didn't want it.
Right.
It was just a fluke almost that this got into the legislation.
Now, you write that literally the word "and radio" was taped into the text of the document.
Yeah, they, 'cause this was before we had word processors,
right?
So they had Xerox machines at the time, but they literally pasted in those words where it said public television. It would say they would cover the word television with broadcasting,
mm-hmm.
or they would slip in "and radio." So it was a last minute thing, not something that the people had in mind at all. But it was a few folks, primarily, almost totally from university stations, who quietly lobbied and got this stuck in there.
It was, as you say, very contentious, and there was a bit of a sort of argument going back and forth. It was going to be the Corporation for Public Television.
That's right.
And the National the name of the act, I forget
Public
exactly.
Television Act.
Right, Public Television Act. And essentially, there was some trickery involved in getting radio inserted into the final bill.
Yeah, a little underhanded. Not exactly the most honorable moment in public radio's history, but the key people operating, doing this, were from the University of Michigan, which at that time was sort of taking the leadership here. And they got their senator, Senator Griffin of Michigan, to slip in the words, make these changes.
Mm-hmm.
But they had agreed with the television people. There had been a big peace conference, and they agreed that there would be that they would leave everything as it was. They would leave the words, it would be the Public Television Act and the Corporation for Public Television, mm-hmm. but they would let the words "and radio" slip in there, so that radio would be sort of a little ancillary piece of the Public Television Act legislation. But Senator Griffin from Michigan suggested that they change it to the Public Broadcasting Act and that radio become a full partner in this thing, violating the agreement that had been made among the radio TV people, the truce. And it was the guy who was the manager at Michigan who talked the senator's staff into this. Now, they said, oh, we never talked to Senator Griffin. It was totally his idea. Well, they're right. They never talked to Senator Griffin. They talked to his staff. And so this made public TV people very angry, and rightly so, because they had a deal, and radio didn't keep it.
Well, not only that, but they also pulled a fast one in getting a chunk of the money that CPB was doling out for public television.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Radio was so weak, and there was so little local support for radio in the institutions compared to the big city TV stations. And the theory had been that it would be kind of a matching system, that the amount of money you raised in your community would be matched by the corporation, which meant that there would be very little, a very small portion of it would go to radio, right, if at all. And radio, once again, through some machinations, managed to get that eventually up to the point that 25% was guaranteed to radio, which meant that a quarter of the money that public television expected to get through all this ended up going to radio instead.
One might imagine in public broadcasting that the TV and the radio people would be on the same side, but that certainly was not the case here. And in fact, the people who got radio inserted into the federal bill, you write, they won their battle, but they were ostracized from any further connection with the system.
Yeah, basically, the folks who did it, none of those who were involved in that process were allowed to actually hold jobs at National Public Radio, because it was still dominated by the whole industry by television, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting really was television-oriented. And the folks who were in control of public television or public broadcasting were television people. So they were very angry at these individuals, and as a result, those folks who actually got the programming radio into the act never really did anything, were allowed to do anything on the national level afterwards. And a whole kind of new group of people who came, some of them came over from television, some came from other places, actually put public radio together at the national level.
We're almost in our midpoint already. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking during this hour of Focus 580 with Jack Mitchell. He is the author of the book Listener Supported, The Culture and History of Public Radio, a book we're discussing. He also teaches journalism and mass communications at the University of Wisconsin, and he was, in fact, the first producer of All Things Considered at National Public Radio. If you'd like to join our conversation, all you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here, or if you're listening on the internet, anywhere on the continental U.S., 800-222-9455.
I should mention that Frank Schooley from the University of Illinois, who was director of broadcasting there at the time, was kind of straddled a fence. He was a radio guy and also a leader in television, but managed to come out of this thing without offending anybody, and ended up on the national the Corporation for Public Broadcasting board. Illinois, and of course, Illinois at one time was the home of the NAEB, the radio division of it was right there on the campus at the university. So Illinois has a big role to play in all of this.
Certainly, as does Wisconsin and Michigan.
Yep,
proud Big Ten institutions. Let's talk about how the public radio system then evolved. What were its ideals and purposes, and how did they relate to the examples of educational radio? You write about the BBC and also Pacifica, which we haven't really touched upon.
Yeah, well, it's complicated. There, people ask, what was the purpose of public radio? Yeah. And there was no single purpose. There were a number of different ideas that had percolated up at one place or another. And they came together in kind of an uncomfortable alliance to some extent, and various views have prevailed from time to time. The one image was educational radio, the university radio, the idea of extending the values of the university, the free speech, civilized inquiry, discussion, that sort of thing. Basically, not anti-establishment by any means, much more academic. There was also then sort of an anti-establishment streak that came primarily from Pacifica Radio, which is a whole another entity that began separately from the university stations. And this was more of a notion of grassroots and anti-establishment kind of a tone. And public radio, more than public television, I think, had a strong sense of that in the very beginning. Remember, this was the 1960s, when the campus, what were the campuses like? Well, there were demonstrations, there was tear gas, there were the civil rights movement going on, the anti-war movement. The campuses were a hotbed of anti-establishment feeling. And as a result, public radio sort of had that sense. It was really reflecting their campuses in that period when NPR began. So it's a combination of say the sort of the best academic style of civilized discussion, along with the notion that we need to be alternative to the commercial media, and that there's going to be an alternative point of view here, and that there would be also the notion of diversity, that people of all sorts would come together, discuss things, and that they should be open to people who are anti-war as well as those who were supporting the war, and that they should actually listen to each other instead of just yelling at each other. So public radio was to be this forum, that notion of civilized debate among all the various interests and factions in the country coming together in this one organization.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that, but we have a couple callers waiting, and we'd like to engage in some civilized debate with them as well. We'll go first to a Champaign listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. Sort of date myself here. I began listening to All Things Considered really from the beginning. I was freshman in college in 1970, and that's pretty much when it started.
Yeah, 1971.
And so, I got a pretty good understanding of how it's changed, and you sort of alluded to that, and it was pretty exciting stuff in the beginning. And while I think that WILL has improved itself in its own broadcasting over the last few years, especially some of its locally originated programming. I have to say that NPR and PBS especially have, in many respects, to my way of thinking, have really gone downhill. Sometimes I think of NPR, especially in the lead up to the current war, as National Pentagon Radio. I'm especially troubled by the way Scott Simon has direction he's gone in Weekend Edition, and I'm also very troubled by this whole business with Tomlinson, and was very discouraged that my favorite program now got cut back from an hour to half an hour, and was surrounded with the likes of, I find it really embarrassing that they have Tucker Carlson on PBS. That's as bad as having the Wall Street Journal gang on there. Intellectually, I find it embarrassing that they would stoop to have, somebody of the lesser caliber of a Tucker Carlson on. And I guess I want to get, your feedback, and if you think that's a problem or not, and what we can do about it.
Okay, a lot going on there. First of all, public radio has changed. I won't mention I'm going to TV, because TV, in a sense, never really was able to realize anywhere near the promise that was made at the time of the Public Broadcasting Act. President Nixon pretty much squelched the thing and strangled it at birth, so it just never, it's survived and done some great things from time to time, but it's not been what people envisioned it to be. Public radio did much better, and it's partly because the NPR organization was set up in Washington as a very strong centralized organization, which could give a sense of purpose and style to public radio, that a consistency that TV never really had. Over the years, public radio has become much more conventionally journalistic. It's probably the best broadcast journalism around, but it's not necessarily all that alternative in tone. And in the beginning, and say during the Vietnam era, we thought that we were being fair and balanced, but in fact, the entire staff was pretty clearly, hated the war, and that, and we did not, we saw ourselves as an alternative, so we had a lot of war critics on, and more so than the main media did, and we saw ourselves as debating the war, as opposed to covering what was going on, what was being said in Saigon, and so, and public radio is not that way now. It's much more very, very strong, and I'd say quite a professional and reasonably objective and balanced coverage of mainstream. But it's not that different from, say, the tone of the New York Times or other, good organizations. So that's happened, and partly it's because commercial news became so bad over the years, particularly on commercial radio, that there was a huge hole for kind of a mainstream operation, which NPR has become. The whole thing about the current situation in terms of Tomlinson, I don't think it's going to have much impact. First of all, CPB doesn't provide all that much money anymore. It's only about 10 or 12% of the total public radio budget, and the money all goes to stations. None of it goes to NPR. And as a result, it kind of gets washed in with all the other money, and it's pretty hard for CPB to ever really tell NPR what to do, because they don't write checks to NPR. They write checks to WILL, and then ILL buys things from NPR. So it's not, I don't think they're going to have much impact. I think the change is not something dictated from outside so much as their own sense of professionalism and their aspiration to be a national institution, something like the New York Times.
Well, while I definitely think it's better than most commercial broadcasting, I think that, in many respects, they're very much inclined to sort of just, you know, report the government line on things and not really, you know, be as brave in terms of delving in and saying, well, you know, what is as close as we can find it, the objective truth here, rather than just, you know, continuing to basically not be as investigative as they ought to be. And, well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call. Well, and you devote a section of the book to an examination of the criticism that's been leveled against, you know, National Public Radio, and I think very insightful sort of set of different perspectives and, you know, valid perspectives. I mean, you know, people have different takes on things.
Yeah, well, the gentleman who just called, I mean, that's a very common criticism.
Yeah.
And Edna's that without validity. Of course, there are a lot of people who make the criticisms from the other side, and there's, you know, some validity to that as well. But there's no question that all the criticism of public radio is not from the right, and that's what we would think from, you know, reading the national media,
right,
that it's the right that's angry at public radio. But in fact, it's it comes from various points of view and people who have different visions of what public radio ought to be, and those who see it as something that should be very questioning of the system and the establishment are disappointed.
We'll go to our next caller, someone in Urbana on line number two. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think my concerns echo those of the first caller. I have heard that, you know, this is just things I've picked up from friends, so I could be totally off base. I have heard that the people who are appointed to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are done so by the president.
That's right.
And that they are beholden, essentially, and he wouldn't appoint them unless they had a very conservative approach, as does he. And also that they are talking about fairness and balance for public radio once again, which I wish they would go back to talking about for the, quote, free press, and that there is talk of every time there is one person who might take a stand on global warming, and although most scientists now do believe there is something called global warming, even though our president does not, that you must also give equal time, even if it's only a small percentage of the actual scientists who say there is no such thing as global warming, that you must give equal time to the non-global warming people.
Yeah.
Do I have that straight?
Well, you have you have most of it straight, not all of it. But,
okay.
The board, let's start with the board. The board, the idea originally for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Board was it's going to be very distinguished Americans in the arts and in arts and letters and journalism. And you'd expect people like great, you know, Broadway directors or writers, Saul Bellow, and people like that would be on the board of the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And what's actually happened is that it's become a political
playground.
Job. Yeah, and it's not for the good people, not the best people. I mean, if you have a donor who gives you a ton of money, but you'd be embarrassed to send this person off to be an ambassador somewhere, you got to give them something, so you just throw them on the CPB board. So it's not the most distinguished group of people, and they tend to be sort of not only partisan, but not even very sophisticated or the best partisans,
mm-hmm.
if you will. So the board is not great. The good news is that they don't have all that much power. They can yammer and talk about all they want, but in terms of their ability to actually have much influence on the actual content of public radio, at least, because they don't actually write money checks to NPR, is limited. The notion of fairness and objectivity, balance, is a complicated one. Well, it's not all that complicated, but it's often a confusing one in journalism as a whole, and in public radio in addition to all journalism. But the idea of objectivity is that you will seek the truth and that you will use semi-quasi-scientific methods to get to the truth. which means that if you find the evidence says that there is global warming, that's you would say so, having gone through a process of looking at all the evidence, and you'd come to a conclusion that is your approximation of truth. That's different from balance, in which you say, okay, there are two sides of this issue, and 90% of the scientists think this, but 10% think that, therefore it has to be balanced. I think objectivity should be the goal of public radio, to seek for truth, of all journalism, as a matter of fact. You need to make sure that you do represent contrary points of view, but they are not equally valid. And that's one of the confusions. And in the public television legislation, it says objectivity and balance. Well, they're not the same. And I think that if we, that most people who listen to public broadcasting or public TV want objectivity. You want somebody pushing toward some approximation of truth. But what's being suggested now is that they emphasize the notion of balance. So you have one person says this, somebody else says that, without much evaluation of who's really closer to right.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. We have another person waiting. Line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I apologize. I got distracted by another talk show inside the Beltway, and I wanted to listen to this all. I guess I'll replay it off the website. But since Tomlinson has come up without being named, I wanted to point out that he also is on the board of a some kind of standing advisory committee that advises such organs as Radio Free Europe and that sort of thing. Yeah. And I think that's a bit of a conflict of interest in it. It also brings to me to point out that some of the people in NPR, like Kevin Klein, came right out of the USIA. Overseas, shall we call it, propaganda units, and, right. And that's very disturbing to me.
Yeah.
I don't know how you'll react to that.
Okay, well, there's like a couple of different situations here. Tomlinson is actually chairman of the board of the organization that oversees international broadcasting, and to have the same person essentially overseeing our propaganda operations abroad, and then have and then also be in charge of public broadcasting internally, I think is outrageous, and just shows makes the assumption that public broadcasting in this country is supposed to be the same as our overseas operations. And there is a difference. There's a big difference. Now, Kevin Close, who is the president of NPR, was head of the of Radio Free Europe and I think maybe VOA for a while. I'm not sure about that. But he comes out of the Washington Post and was a correspondent there, an editor for many years, and then got tired of that, I guess, and spent a few years doing this international broadcasting. And one of his goals was to make it more objective and less propagandistic, but it was still, that was his basic nature. When he is, there's no finer public broadcaster or journalist than Kevin Close. I mean, he's a wonderful person, and although he does have that background, it doesn't mean that he doesn't understand what public broadcasting is all about. What bothers me is that the administration would see that somehow it's compatible to have the same person in charge of international propaganda and in charge of public broadcasting in this country. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, we could certainly talk more about the current situation and some of the more recent issues in public radio. But I do want to make sure to talk about a couple of the stories that you relay in the book. And certainly the beginning of All Things Considered and the sort of approach that was taken as you were essentially creating it as you went. And also I want to talk about the financial crisis in 1983 and sort of how that has set the stage for the current situation with regard to, what the CPB can or cannot do to public radio. So maybe we could start there, because I think it's an important thing for people to understand how the finances actually work, perhaps, and why they came to work that way.
Yeah. Well, the original way that public radio was set up was that NPR was paid for totally by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. they would write a check. It came every month, and it was a big one. And that's what paid all the bills. And that worked not great, because there never is enough money, but okay, until 1980, when President Reagan was inaugurated, and he was philosophically opposed to the idea of public broadcasting. He wasn't about to control it. He wasn't going to try to change its content or anything. He just didn't think the federal government should be paying for it. And so as a result, he unilaterally cut the corporation's budget by 25%, which had a relatively small impact on most public broadcasting, because most public broadcasters were funded in part by the federal government, but mostly by state governments and by listeners and viewers, etc. But NPR was the only entity that was totally dependent on CPB, because they'd only got one check, and when that was cut by 25%, his budget was cut by 25%. Due to mismanagement and a variety of other things, the place almost went bankrupt. And to pull it out, coming out of that near bankruptcy, the stations took over responsibility for paying for NPR. And CPB stopped sending a check to NPR and instead sent lots of little checks to the stations. And the stations then would buy programming from NPR. So as a result, the stations now have the responsibility, and it means that CPB is much more divorced from NPR than it ever was before. When they were writing the single check, obviously they had the potential of great control. They never, as far as I know, really exercised it, and I would have been in a position to know because I was on the receiving end of the check. But now there's very little ability to do that because it is all through stations, and the stations are a real filter, a real buffer.
So cuts to the CPB budget would affect the stations,
right,
but not to the extent that it would have in the past, because the money is a lesser slice of the pie,
yeah.
Anyway. Yeah,
yeah, it's only about 10 or 12%.
Right. Well, another thing I wanted to mention: Don Mullally's role in all this, in the restructuring of the financial arrangements.
Yeah, he's Don Mullally, who is director of the WILL stations, is a very important figure in the recent history of public broadcasting. By recent, I mean the last 30 years or so. And he came to, I think there are two things that that he did that are really memorable. First, when NPR went into bankruptcy or close to it, the existing board had to be removed, the existing management had to be removed, and Don took on the job of being chairman of the board of NPR during this time of crisis, and offered tremendous sense of stability and wisdom. He was just kind of an old timer in public radio at that time, and so he had a sense of history and integrity that, and he's a very articulate gentleman. So he was able to lead very, very nicely and get us through that period. Then, somewhat later, he continued as board chair, and then he was one of the authors of this new plan to send all the money to the stations and then have the money come back to NPR. It didn't go through exactly as he proposed it. His plan was better, but it was what we got was certainly far better than what we had before, and Don was central to that. I think everybody in public radio who's been around a while remembers that time and the great leadership and sense of integrity and stability that he offered.
Well, we have just about 6 or 7 minutes left with our guest, Jack Mitchell, author of the book Listener Support of the Culture and History of Public Radio. He was the first producer of All Things Considered. And if you'd like to get into the conversation in the time remaining, you better do so quickly. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I want to turn now to the origins of All Things Considered as the first national offering from NPR. And you were the first producer.
Right.
What was the discussion like about how to craft this new program?
Well, it was very, very loose.
Yeah.
You have to understand how informal public radio was in those days. for the first 6 months, there was no producer. It was a matter of there were a group of people who came in to work in the morning and kind of as a commune, which was sort of a actually reasonable, reasonably common. This was probably 1971 here.
Yeah.
That notion of no structure, and we were into that. And so for the beginning, there was no producer. Finally, they decided somebody had to be in charge, and it was kind of a consensus of who should be the person, and it turned out to be me. There was no real structure, and there was until I tried to create one, and there was conflicting views on what the program was supposed to be. Notice that it's not called the NPR Nightly News. It's called All Things Considered. And that title tells a lot about what we were thinking about at the time. It was not going to be a news program, necessarily. It was to be a daily magazine that would cover all the things that public radio ought to be interested in, including the news. But also, there might be some music, there might be some drama, poetry. There were all kinds of things that we tried to fit into this 90-minute hole that we faced every day. And it was obviously, to have a coherent program, you couldn't, it just couldn't go on like that. And so we had to focus it. We had to give it some structure. We had to organize, have some kind of a staff structure. And it became more and more news-like as time went on. It became more newsy under my administration when I was in charge. And it became dramatically more newsy over time. So the notion of being all things, cover everything, and considered, give thoughtful consideration to every issue, that was the notion of that title. And the notion of depth is still there, but the notion of covering this whole range of public radio content, that disappeared within the first year or two.
We have just about 5 minutes left, or a little bit less. I want to squeeze in one last caller, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask if you had any idea of the difference in funding from the federal budget between public radio in America versus all of the propaganda radio that we send out in Europe and all of that. Just my point would be I would think we would be interested as a nation in broadcasting to ourselves at least as much as broadcasting propaganda to others. And I'll hang up and take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers, but I do know that we spend far more on international broadcasting than we do, at least in terms of the federal government's contribution to public broadcasting here. The entire public broadcasting enterprise, radio, TV, all sources of money is something like $2 billion. That may be more than what we spend abroad, but the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's contribution to that, of course, is only about 10% or so. And so I'm sure that the federal government spends much more on international broadcasting than domestic, which is different from other countries. The British are the best in probably both domestic and international broadcasting, and it's all part of the same organization, interestingly. But the domestic side of the BBC is far larger than the international side.
There's so many things I'd like to ask you about, but we only have like 3 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you to talk about maybe the future a little bit. With technology changing so quickly, what do you see as the future for public radio? Is it a place that can fulfill its original vision? Is it going to be easier to do that with new technology, or are there greater challenges?
Yeah. Well, one of the good things about the new technology is that it's going to be able to offer a lot more different services. And to the idea that public radio is supposed to be providing different programming, all kinds of choices on that, then that's certainly going to be possible. Technically, whether it's possible economically is another matter, but technically that's going to be possible. I think the great thing, perhaps, will be that national programming is available now, if you're really to anybody in the world. You can sit in Madison or Champaign and listen to All Things Considered on the Internet from New York or Boston or wherever. You can get the national stuff from all kinds of places, and it'll become even more common later, which is going to offer the local stations the opportunity to become really important in their local communities. Just retailing or passing on the national programming is not going to be enough in the future for public radio stations. They're going to have to be really tied into their communities and be essential to the lives of their communities, which was one of the original notions of public broadcasting, the notion of, that is built on the bedrock of localism, to use the phrase in the legislation. But public radio, at least, has not been primarily local. Its main identity has been national since almost from the beginning with NPR. And now, out of necessity, but I think also out of just the opportunity that it's provided by for us, we can be closer to our local communities while still making available all of the national material, that wealth of stuff that's out there. So I think it's a wonderful time technologically. So the economics is another matter, but I believe that public radio has become so valuable to so many people that one way or another the funding will come, as long as it's meaningful to people. Either they'll write their own checks or they'll pressure their government to support it. But if it's meaningful to people, it will survive and do very well. If it's meaningless, if it's just another radio service, it's not going to be. And so the potential for being meaningful to people is essential to the survival and the prosperity of public radio, and I think that's good.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. The book is Listener Supported, The Culture and History of Public Radio, recently published by Prager Publishing. The author has been our guest, Jack Mitchell, and so you can look for that in bookstores and libraries. And to you, Jack Mitchell, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, great.